broadcasting from the Unshackled Studios in Melbourne. This is Wilms Front, brought to you by theunshackled.net. Now here's Tim Wilms.
Hello everyone and welcome to this end of week edition of Wilms Front. Today is Friday, the 16th of October, 2020. We are live on the Wilms Front YouTube, DLive and the Unshackled's Facebook page. As always, we are live on the YouTube and DLive enhanced software, Entropy, which I've put the link into the live chat. So you can, throughout the show, ask a question or send through a super chat. It is 7 p.m. here in still lockdown Melbourne. We are awaiting another Dan decision day this Sunday about what restrictions will ease and what businesses will be allowed to reopen. The political, media, and legal pressure on Dan to free Victorians continue to pile up, especially after today's daily figures, which I'll put up on the screen now. So we had two daily new cases today. That was after 16,381 test results in the last 24 hours, no deaths. We're now down to 157 active cases. And as you can see there, 19,279 have recovered, and we only have 14 now in hospital. No cases in ICU, and none are on a ventilator. And yesterday we had 6 cases, and the day before we've basically had the same amount of daily cases as the state of New South Wales has had. As you can see through this meme, which has been shared on Liberal Federal MP Craig Kelly's Facebook page, you can see here that Victoria versus New South Wales. So Victoria, 15th of October, 6 positive cases. As you can see, it basically looks like a concentration camp. And there you have New South Wales, 6 positive COVID cases, yet open for business, and anyone can go to the beach as they like. Say hello if you're in either the Facebook or YouTube live chats, because I noticed that few people are slow to get on, so make sure you say hello. All right, so breaking late Friday this afternoon was the news that the hotel quarantine inquiry, it put on Twitter that the Board of Inquiry will hold an extraordinary sitting at 2 p.m. on Tuesday, 20th of October. Further details to be announced. This was because late this Friday afternoon is that's when Daniel Andrews and former Police Commissioner Graham Ashton turned over their phone records to the Board of Inquiry. The phone records have only began to be asked by the Board of Inquiry thanks to Sky News host Peter Credlin, who has been attending Dan's daily press briefings trying to get to the bottom of who gave the contracts to Unified Security, which was they were the company they were getting $30 million from the Victorian taxpayer to guard returning travellers, and 99% of the second wave can be genomically tested to breaches in Victoria's hotel quarantine program. We still don't know on that fateful day, March 27th, who decided that private security would be used and that unified security should be utilised. Peter Credlin, she was not on Sky News tonight, obviously going through those phone records, but she did post this up on her Facebook page in the past hour. We can only hope that the coat inquiry now redeems itself and goes hard after the truth for the 800 dead Victorians, for the small businesses in ruin, for the workers out of work, for the suicides and the suffering, for those who died alone, and for all of us who want competence and integrity in our government. I've cleared out my diary on Tuesday, by the way, in case council assisting needs extra hands on deck. A bit of a swipe there at Rachel Elliard's cross-examination of all of the Victorian government ministers and public servants, who basically had amnesia and said, no, I don't recall anything. Pissy Leaks Pete is in the chat. Tim, I just saw people on the beach today, dude. Yes, it's 2 weeks ago since Paul Dowsley did his live cross for Seven News at St Kilda Beach, where there are all those people who were breaching social distancing, not wearing masks at the beach, and everyone thought that there was going to be a St Kilda Beach cluster by now. There hasn't been because, well, it was a warm day 2 weeks ago last Friday. I called it virus frying weather, and it's improbable that you get the virus transmits in open outside warm spaces. And lo and behold, 2 weeks later, there is no St Kilda Beach cluster. In fact, there haven't been any new clusters in the past few days. Obviously, the Chadstone cluster at the Butcher Club, it first spread to Kilmore, but then it was discovered that truck driver who'd gone to Kilmore had also been to Shepparton as well after three positive cases were confirmed there on Wednesday. Nearly the whole town turned up for testing the last few days. All I think they've processed about 1,000 tests so far. They have basically found no more positive people. And that truck driver visited Shepparton on the 30th of September. It's now October 16th now. And yes, they found it was 2 weeks after it. Obviously, the virus has a 2-week incubation period. So it's not surprising that they only found three positives. And if that person did give the virus to others, they would have recovered by now. So basically, well, I think the Victorian Department of Health and Human Services is actually impressed with their own recent competence and the fact that they've got the Kilmore and Shepparton clusters under control. There's still a lot to be desired out of Victoria's contact tracing capability as we open up, given some of the still inconsistencies about contacting and isolating close contacts. We are basically in lockdown because of Dan Andrews and his government's own incompetence. There are 2,600 contact tracers in the Victorian Department of Health and Human Services. Yet they still can't get on top of all these clusters, but they have managed to get it down to two today. So you can well and truly say that the second wave of the coronavirus, it's in its last breath. Obviously, as I mentioned, pressure is piling up on Dan Andrews to reopen. In his daily press briefing today, he tried to tout that my strategy has worked and it's good that we didn't listen to all the other people who said that we should reopen quicker, basically saying, like, look, I saved Victoria, even though it was my incompetence that caused this second wave and pushed the state to its knees. But what also would be playing on his mind is the lawsuits that are beginning to pile up against his government. There was first the challenge to the curfew by Mornington Peninsula restaurant owner that it was disproportionate response, that it violated the Victorian Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities. And now there's a second lawsuit that was only filed at the beginning of the week, and it's already gone to the High Court. So the Victorian, this is just broken today. The Victorian government has been handed 4 days to figure out how to respond to a High Court challenge against its COVID-19 lockdown. In a short hearing on Friday afternoon, Justice Virginia Bell said there was a possibility the matter could be heard on November 6th. If the government moves to dismiss the claim on legal grounds. The challenge has been brought by Victorian man Julian Gurner, who owns the Morgan Sorrento restaurant and bar on the Mornington Peninsula. He said aspects of Victoria's lockdown, including the 5-kilometre travel restriction, state home orders and essential worker permits, violate the implied right to freedom of movement in the Constitution. Mr. Guinness and his mental health and businesses suffered under the strict measures implemented by the Andrews government. The $250,000 his restaurant made in April 2019 diverted just $25,000 in April this year. according to a writ in the High Court. So his barrister is Michael Wiles, QC, representing the Victorian government is their Solicitor General Kirsten Walker, QC. She said the Victorian government was still deciding if it would file a defence, demur, or do both. A demur is a type of objection to the other party's case that does not dispute the facts of the matter, but says their legal argument cannot hold. It would allow for a quick decision on a question of law, the state said in a written submission. A defence would tackle the legal and factual basis of the claim and take longer to determine. So they'd get until Tuesday, 2:15 p.m. Tuesday, to decide if the Victorian government is going to demur or not. So basically, Tuesday is going to be a big, I would say, a day in the legal history of Victoria. Well, given the Andrews government has to put its High Court defence or demur to the challenge to the lockdown, and also the hotel quarantine special hearing, which we don't know who the witnesses will be. I suspect the reason why Peter Credlin, she was not on her show tonight, but she did make that Facebook post. Basically, she's probably going through all those phone records. That's what she's been doing when she's not on air and not at the press conferences, just going into those documents that have been submitted to the hotel quarantine inquiry. She's a qualified lawyer and barrister and obviously knows how government works, given that she was Tony Abbott's chief of staff, worked in various political offices over the years. She's certainly been able to get to the bottom of this better than all of the Melbourne Press Pack and the Board of Inquiry itself. Last night on the Uncuckables, we spoke about the Rebel Business, Harry's Clothing in Berwick, which is reopened, owned by Harry Hutchinson. Victoria Police, they visited his workplace. They look like they are going to issue him a $10,000 fine for breaching the Chief Health Officer Brett Sutton's directions. And now tomorrow, Adam and Weave Hair Salon and Barber in Hughesdale said they are going to reopen regardless of the Chief Health Officer's directions. Obviously, we've seen the various Freedom Day protests in Melbourne over the past month, but this is the first time that actual businesses have decided to defy the lockdown orders. So, well, who knows what's going to be announced on Sunday by Danny. He's promised significant steps out of lockdown. Of course, we've known to expect little from Dan's announcements, but the whole state will hold its breath on Sunday to see what he says. But as things stand right now here on a Friday night in Victoria, we are still in lockdown. And as I said, rest of Australia's states and territories are open for business. But this has also meant local Marxist activists have resumed their public gatherings at university campuses, their favourite stomping grounds, to cause disruption and rebel rouse about their pit issues. Earlier today, I caught up with the Unshackled's contributor and Marxist and Antifa expert Lucas Roses, who's been writing about the return of Marxists at Sydney and Brisbane universities this week, and also which groups and personalities are behind this renewed Marxist activism.
This is Will's Front, brought to you by theunshackled.net.
Lucas, welcome back to Will's Front.
G'day, Tim. How are you?
Oh, I'm not too bad, considering I'm still in lockdown Melbourne. You're in, pretty much open Queensland there. Which, well, yeah, rest of the country,
much nicer up in the Sunshine State.
Rest of the country is open, and well, the Marxists in those states are clearly open for, I wouldn't use the word business because they hate business, but they're certainly back out on the street, causing as much chaos, intimidation, and destruction as possible.
They certainly are. They couldn't wait to get back out on the streets, and now they're really getting into it. It's almost like they've been got pent up with a bit of blue balls, and now they're just letting rip.
Coronavirus is an extreme risk still in Victoria, according to the Marxists and the Greens, but everywhere else, we should be allowed to have the biggest protests we like. That's apparently their logic, even though today New South Wales and Victoria recorded around the same COVID cases.
Oh yeah, that doesn't have to make sense. But yeah, it is interesting looking at the little double standards that they have. It has appealed, has actually sort of become clear to some of the people on the far left as well that they are sort of in a little bit of muddy waters here. But yeah, they still feel very free to condemn anyone in Melbourne who's an anti-lockdown sort of person, whilst at the same time being outraged that New South Wales police would try and shut down protests around the University of Sydney.
Well, they love the Premier of Victoria, Comrade Dan, who is as close to a communist as they're going to get. So, of course, they're not going to complain too much about his leadership. But, New South Wales has, what do they call her? What, koala killer, Gladys. That's what they refer to her.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. But hey, look, you never know. Melbourne might end up getting a more sort of a radical premier at some stage. Never say never.
Who knows? It's foolish to predict the future, as 2020 has shown us.
And yeah, there's plenty of people waiting in the wings who'd love to take Dan's job, and they're far more extreme than him.
Queensland, your native state, is going to an election, which is probably why the Marxists up there are willing to do so much protests, even though they have a Labor Premier up there, Anastasia Palaszczuk, or as she's been increasingly called now, referred to as Palaszczuk, or just the Chook, because it's basically a contest between her and Dan about who's the worst Premier. But the LNP could win on October 31st. Deb Frecklington could become the Premier, though she's doing a pretty good job, and so is the LNP, of basically sabotaging their own campaign.
Oh yeah, they never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity up here. It's just like how in the last state election, 2017, the LNP decided to put One Nation down below the Labor Party, and it ended up costing them government. They could have been in a coalition or a minority government with One Nation support, but instead they decided to virtue signal about how not racist they are. And yeah, so they ended up with another electoral cycle of the Chook. I've never actually known what the proper pronunciation of her last name is. I apologise to any sort of Eastern European or Slavic listeners who are out there.
Oh, people are deliberately just calling her Palaszczuk now because it's how she doesn't like her name pronounced.
Well, yeah, I'm sure there's a correct way.
But
I just don't care.
I shouldn't say it's her comrades, more Jackie Trad's comrades, the former Deputy Premier and Treasurer who stood aside during a Crime and Corruption Commission probe. She's the member for South Brisbane, which takes in West End, which is basically, you'd describe it as the Fitzroy or Newtown of Brisbane, and certainly the local Marxist activity there has festered out to a lot of Brisbane there, and they seem to have centred on the University of Queensland for most of their Marxist activism. How far is that away from West End?
They're not immediately close to each other. I mean, UQ has its the extremists who are doing the organising on UQ are distinct from the ones who mostly do the stuff around West End. Two different groups. The one around West End generally is they call the Unite Group, sort of a coalition of the former Brisbane branch of the Socialist Alliance and local, sort of local anarchist groups as well. And they're fairly well connected with guys like Jonathan Three, the houseboat living local Greens councillor for Woolloongabba. And that's sort of his patch around there. They have a community centre there, which they use to hold musical events and fundraisers and that sort of stuff. It used to be the Resistance Centre, the branch office of the Socialist Alliance. But there was a split from the Socialist Alliance a few years ago when... because the Brisbane branch was much younger and had a lot more sort of new blood in it. Socialist Alliance elsewhere in Australia tends to be sort of deteriorating and dying off because they've had most of their recruiting grounds taken by Socialist Alternative. Now, that's mainly who's doing the attack on Prime Minister Morrison the other day at University of Queensland was the Marxists involved there were Socialist Alternative. And they're in the middle of their student elections period, I think they are there. So it was quite easy for them to grab some activists and go over and try and successfully disrupt the Prime Minister's day.
I know the fact that there's student union elections at UQ basically because Drew Pavlov, the anti-CCP activist, who is actually, he's most aligned his politics with the Greens, but he's an old school leftist who cares about human rights. It's how they used to be 20 years ago. So he's quite the, you would say, a independently minded, which makes him quite unique from the rest of the modern progressive left. Let's focus first on the Prime Minister Scott Morrison's visit. He's in Queensland to campaign for Deb Frecklington, the LNP opposition leader, but he was at UQ to basically check out their coronavirus vaccine trial, and his car got tomatoes thrown at it. Was it the tomatoes that caused
red paint?
Yeah, but there were tomatoes
red,
as
red
well.
Paint, and the next day they tracked him down as well and threw Brussels sprouts with red paint on them at the car. I don't know if there was actually tomatoes, but there was a lot of red paint involved.
I saw some tomatoes on the news. I know that tomatoes couldn't have been capable of causing that amount of red on his the police car that he was shuffled out on. They hit one of the, I think it was actually federal police and security with the red. But for me, who's been living under the Victorian police state, with we've seen the Victoria police arresting women and grandmothers at beaches, and yet in University of Queensland, these Marxists are throwing things at the Prime Minister of all people, and he's running out to a police vehicle to escape.
Running out the back door and getting chucked in the back of a divvy van to escape. Mm. I mean, it is really, really worrying that the Prime Minister's security detail didn't realise first, because even like you say yourself, you knew that there's student elections going on at UQ, all right? And during student elections, all of the various different student groups, they're out, put on various shirts with the electoral front names on them, and they're going around desperately trying to get some of the students who do not give a flying fuck about those elections to actually vote. And that's been the way for decades and decades and decades. And the fact that the Prime Minister's security detail and the intelligence services who are supposed to be advising that security detail didn't realise that bringing the Prime Minister onto a campus, even no matter how quietly you've done it, on the same day that you've already got a Marxist group with their activists on campus and organised, wouldn't potentially lead to some issues is gobsmacking. Right? You've got all these ASIO agents who are apparently out there searching down evil far-right extremists and apparently looking after Sunni terrorism as well. And not a single one of them, not a single sort of intelligence service for the state police or for the federal police or for the federal agencies like ASIO seems to have paid any attention to the fact that the Prime Minister might be put in a position where he has to run out the back door and get bundled into a divvy van, and it's supposed to be the Prime Minister of the country. It's ridiculous. Absolutely sort of laughable.
And it's hardly a new phenomenon that when a conservative politician visits a university campus, whether they're student elections or not, there's going to be leftist Marxist students who are going to protest. I mean, off the top of my head, Julie Bishop basically had to get through, this was in 2014, a mosh pit of leftist students to get out. I think it was the University of Sydney, which we'll get to in a moment.
That was University of Sydney. Yeah, no, that was a hilarious one because the guy who got, I think, eventually charged, but the charge was dropped with assaulting Jolly Bishop, was Tom Rowe, who became the Greens
Oh,
candidate
the
who,
bestiality guy.
yeah, the bestiality and necrophilia guy was the guy who tried to throw Jolly Bishop down a set of stairs at the University of Sydney, which is, interesting tidbit. But the ones at University of Queensland, it's like, how would you? I believe they thought that because there was no prior announcement that this was going to happen, that it was kept quiet, that they wouldn't have to worry about protesters or anything like that sort of stuff. But the fact that they didn't even know that there were student elections going on, so all the people who organised the protest would already actually be there, right, organised, ready to go, is just, it's a laughable breach of security. And yeah, the fact that these people are in charge of keeping the Prime Minister safe makes me wonder why we haven't lost more Prime Ministers than just Harold Holt.
Has anyone been charged over the vandalism?
Yeah, there was one 19-year-old girl charged. She doesn't appear to be one of the main members of the group.
Okay, well, I guess that's a start.
Yeah, but considering that, covering police in paint, assaulting security guards, vandalizing a building, vandalizing one of the extremely expensive, I think they're BMW ministerial cars, the bulletproof ones, and forcing the Prime Minister on television to be bundled out the back of a building into the back of a dune van is just,
And the Marxist rise in Brisbane has really, I think, fallen under the radar because, well, City of Brisbane's come a long day since the conservative iron fist rule of Sir Joh Bjelke-Petersen in the 70s and 80s. Last year, Brisbane was the home of all those Extinction Rebellion protesters who superglued themselves to roads and various other public works. They began to go back out onto the street when the coronavirus restrictions were lifted in Queensland, and they've been basically camping outside this asylum seeker detention facility at Kangaroo Point, where there's been various scuffles with the Queensland police.
Well, yeah, you mentioned Sir Joh Bjelke-Petersen. It's interesting that you say that because the groups that are around today are directly descended from the groups that he was fighting with the Queensland police back in those days and trying to keep from disrupting, holding disruptive protests and that sort of stuff. For instance, back then it was the International Socialists, or which became the International Socialist Organisation. And the International Socialist Organisation eventually split off and dissolved, it's a long story, that has its successor groups, Socialist Alternative and Solidarity. And Socialist Alternative was, of course, the one that attacked Prime Minister Morrison, and Solidarity is the one that's been instrumental in organising those Kangaroo Point protests. So they are all tied together. These are all sort of groups which have a succession, groups that have an activist base going back decades. It really shouldn't come as much of a surprise. They have grown rapidly in recent years, but from a very small base. The Extinction Rebellion and the Uni Students for Climate Justice protests that really sort of sprung up last year in Brisbane were organised by socialist alternative activists like Catherine Robertson and Carl Jackson, who I believe were not from UQ, they were QUT students, or QUT. I know that Catherine originally came from Melbourne, and that's another sort of tendency. Marxist activists, they do tend to move their younger activists around the countryside to try and sort of seed new organisations at new universities. But yeah, these are all connected groups, and they're all, like, nearly every campaign is run by the same groups, just simply with different faces and different front groups on the front.
Yes, it's come to our attention that Tom Tanuki, real name Thomas Stevens, who's the leader of Yelling at Racist Dogs, he's left Melbourne to go up to Brisbane because he started filming the public protests that he doesn't like up there, the freedom picnics and anti-lockdown rallies.
Yeah, he's been associated with various Marxist groups as well. He's more associated with anarchists. He was hanging around a cafe in Melbourne, which is known for sort of its anarchist connections. He's connected through some of his friends with the old WikiLeaks party, which has sort of connections to autonomous and anarchist-related sort of zones. He made a speech at several socialist alternative meetings, including one before the protest that Socialist Alternative organised against Jordan Peterson in Melbourne. And so, yeah, he's got various connections to extremist groups. But again, it's like you say, he's the leader of Yelling at Racist Aussies. He's pretty much the leader and, as of now, probably the only member left. I was always amazed at how many fat people they managed to get.
Yeah, there's plenty of photos.
It's like, good God, man, like they're paying by the extra inch. So it's like walking billboards with, you know, bellies that show up 10 minutes before the guy turns the corner. And then, of course, Tom himself has a bit of a big pot belly sticking out as well. It's, yeah, they're not the healthiest looking people, that particular crew. It's quite interesting. But, yeah, they're not serious people. They're not a serious group. And Tom Tanuki's not a serious person.
I mentioned before Drew Pavlov, his commentary on the UQ student elections. I just want to get your opinion on him because he's a leftist, but he's sort of an old school leftist, but he has been supportive of the Kangaroo Point refugee protest, though he has teamed up with Pauline Hanson and Bob Catter at various times. He's certainly what you'd describe as a young political madman. He's extremely effective at getting his face out there in the media, and certainly doesn't hold back from a public beef. He's taken on Friendly Geordies this week over what he said about the Uyghur Muslims being in camps because they're causing trouble. And to my point of view, that a online beef between Drew Pavlov and Friendly Geordies, that's a pretty, I would say, equal match.
It's good to put him in the same category as Friendly Geordies because he is in the same category as Friendly Geordies. They're both shameless self-promoters. And just like Friendly Geordies, he's probably going to eventually end up doing ads for the ACTU and for GetUp and taking money in that regard from Green, taking money for Greenpeace as well. And yeah, he'll, yeah, it's Drew is a funny guy, not as funny as Friendly Geordies and not as good a self-promoter yet, but he's on that track. Drew's issues at UQ with the Marxists there is actually really quite interesting in regards to the China protests that he was involved in. So there was clashes between students on both sides of the Hong Kong protests sort of issue. And Drew was very involved in organising protests about that. And Socialist Alternative, including Priya D, who organised the protest against Scott Morrison, was there with a megaphone. She tried to take over on behalf of Socialist Alternative, tried to take over the protests in favour of the Hong Kong protesters. When she found that she couldn't do that, she threw a tantrum and ran off and declared everyone, including Drew, was a white supremacist, including Andrew Bartlett of the Greens. Thinking that at the time the Queensland co-convener of the Greens was also a white supremacist, the Tibetans and the Chinese international students who were protesting were also white supremacists. Everyone was a white supremacist. And it was one of the more amusing things that happened last year in regards to the Marxists at UQ. But yeah, as you can tell, this is a pattern that goes back quite a while. There is a pattern of radicalism on UQ. One of the Socialist Alternative sort of, he's a former member of the faculty there, Tom Bramble. He was a lecturer in industrial relations for many, many years. He's been a member of Socialist Alternative going back to the 1990s. So, yeah, they've had an in at UQ for quite some time.
Let's now go down to the University of Sydney. Now, even though the state of New South Wales is open for business, they have a strict limit on outdoor gatherings of 20. And since the Black Lives Matter protests in early June, which they tried to stop in the Supreme Court of New South Wales, they did a better job of trying to prevent it than a Victorian government did and Dan Andrews. But since then, they've been and also the New South Wales Police have been very strict in enforcing this 20-person outdoor gathering limit. And well, we saw basically the Black Lives Matter Sydney movement fizzle when Paddy Gibson, his unlawful BLM rally, which that was ruled by the Supreme Court, was a flop, and Paddy Gibson got taken away in a paddy wagon, and three people got fined $1,000.
Yeah, that was quite funny. But then as soon as he was released, he was invited to New South Wales Parliament by Jenny Leong and David Shoebridge, who had him sit down. As anyone, just in case anybody doesn't know, Paddy Gibson is a member of Solidarity, one of those revolutionary Trotskyist groups we were talking about just before. And he's an organiser for them. So you've got two elected members of the Greens inviting someone into the New South Wales Parliament who has as one of his openly avowed goals the overthrow of New South Wales Parliament and the Australian Parliament. So quite interesting. But yeah, University of Sydney, there's been a lot of organising there. You've got various sort of groups from University of New South Wales and also from Macquarie and their socialist alternative branches normally, but also other activists are coming from those other universities to the University of Sydney in order to more make up the numbers for these confrontations that they're orchestrating with police. And that's because the police there have gone through the Supreme Court again and have continued to get these marches made illegal. So I think they're up to about $43,000 in fines last check. They just keep grabbing people and fining them. Some people like Adam Adelpour of Solidarity have been arrested so many times now that they're going to be up in court with the potential for 6 months jail. Again, the sort of the stated reason for these protests is against the higher education reforms that the Morrison government is putting through, which would give less money to humanities and more money to STEM courses, which would affect the activist base of the far left groups because that's where most of their activists work.
Those reforms got through the Senate recently with the help of Centre Alliance. I'll just bring up the new. So it's got four bands now, with the cheapest being teaching clinical psychology, English, maths, nursing, language, agriculture, $3,700, allied health, other health, architecture, IT, creative arts, engineering, environmental studies, science, $7,700 per year, medicine, dental, veterinary science, $11,300 per year, and now the most expensive, law, economics, management, commerce, society, culture, humanities, communications, and behavioral science. Basically, all the degrees that are overrated and don't guarantee employment after people have graduated.
Well, yeah, I think it's something like 50% of law graduates in Victoria never do their articles. So that's people who haven't just started a law degree but have finished a law degree. They never actually go on to even qualify for working in law.
Yeah, law and commerce are the new arts, basically.
Yeah, along those lines. A lot of them find work in the NGO sector. With a law degree, you can, you know, still has a bit of prestige to it. But universities love law degrees because they don't require any sort of equipment. They pretty much just require a classroom. You can actually make money off selling the materials, the books and that sort of stuff, and there are a lot of books. So, yeah, it's a course that universities love to pump out way too many people of. Same with communications degrees. It's like most people go into a communications degree because they think that somehow they'll get into journalism. Nah, the only way you get into journalism is to get a degree of some sort and then know people. It's journalism is possibly one of the most nepotistic fields in Australia. It's just absolutely incredible that anyone thinks they can walk into a job, without knowing somebody, without being connected.
And that's the only thing that makes you a so-called accredited journalist, because here in Melbourne, there's been massive screeching by the iStand with Dan Crew. How dare Peter Credlin be allowed into Dan's daily press briefing? She's not an accredited journalist because, well, she hasn't done either a degree or a cadetship. And of course, the concept of that accredited or qualified journalist is a dangerous thing in a democracy, because who gets to decide who's an accredited journalist? The government. But Peter Credlin has shown, with her legal training and experience in a political office, she knows much more. She's been able to investigate much more about how the hotel quarantine private security contracts were set up than any of the so-called accredited journalists who studied at university or done a cadetship.
Well, yeah, and I think it's not so much the government controlling the accreditation. That's not really the goal.
Oh, I'm just talking in overall terms, but yes, it's the mainstream media themselves who decide who's accredited.
Yeah, and well, it's not even that. It's the university systems where journalists are trained. They are the ones who have the most to lose from journalists coming from fields outside of their remit. They are the ones who get to form the viewpoints and the worldviews of future journalists, and they like that. And it does mean that since nearly all journalists now come from that system, we have journalists in Australia who have almost come from either they've been taught by the same teachers or their teachers were taught by the same teachers. So it's a very sort of insular profession now, which is why they tend to think the same way about everything, amongst other reasons.
Yeah, which is why that was that mysterious coordinated campaign against George Christensen for appearing on this program a couple of weeks back.
I think that was just the old BuzzFeed Australia pipeline. Josh Butler and Cam Wilson knowing each other from BuzzFeed Australia, now sadly deceased BuzzFeed Australia, which I'm sure we're all devastated about. And journalists love listening to other journalists quoting other journalists, and until another journalist says it, it's not real.
And, yes, I noticed that Cam Wilson, his proof that I spread conspiracy theories was himself, and apparently I'd been criticized for wearing the Pinochet did nothing wrong shirt by Slack Bastard.
Yeah, so this man is an extremist. Who says he's an extremist? Well, this guy who thinks that all government is illegitimate and should be violently overthrown.
Yeah, and he quoted himself as a source.
Oh, really? That's a new one.
Yeah, this guy spreads conspiracy theories because look at my tweets proving it.
Yeah, if he wasn't in the club, right, the journalism club that he managed to get in, you know, by working at the ABC originally, if he wasn't in that club, he'd just be a laughable idiot sitting on the side of the road that ranting to himself that no one would listen to. And that's it. That's why these people love their accreditation so much and they cling to it, the idea that I'm an accredited journalist or I'm part of the club. If they didn't have that, they'd have nothing.
Even though most of the recent rags they've been writing for are now shut down. Because I think Josh Butler is on his fourth job now, because BuzzFeed Australia shut down, HuffPost Australia shut down, and also 10 Daily recently shut down.
Yeah, does he think maybe if he cuts his hair, he might be able to, you know, go work for someone who doesn't collapse?
I think it's more than just his hair. Well, he is based in Melbourne, to my knowledge, Josh Butler.
He does have terrible, terrible hair. It is awful.
Yeah, basically, peak Antifa, lefty, soy, hipster look.
Nah, the sort of meth teeth hanging out of their head, bad tattoos and piercings, dead-eyed Antifa people that still have better fashion sense than Josh Butler.
Mm. Which is why maybe he doesn't appear on TV much, neither does Keanu. Not even on the drum.
Oh, good God, man. The drum is just, that is good comedy. Good quality comedy if you can sit through it.
It is still easier to get through than Q&A.
Yes, quite. But as people would have noticed from the news, it was just on Wednesday was the last of these protests in University of Sydney that was has been organised by not just Marxist groups, but also members of the Labor left on the student council there, and by Grassroots Independence, which is a group mostly confined to University of Sydney that has traditionally provided activists for the Greens, although not always. And altogether, they've organised various of these protests. They've tried getting around the law in cute little ways. They had a protest where everyone, because the limit is 20 people, they had groups of 20 people spread out across a large quadrangle at UCID, and the police said, nah, you're still part of a single protest, and arrested them. They tried setting up a protest and then had everyone run, sprint, towards a road, which they then blocked to get around the police lines, which they successfully did. That was late September, probably about 2 weeks ago, probably. And just on Wednesday, they had their latest one, which was supported wholeheartedly by staff, naturally, particularly Dr. Nick Reimer, who's also another member of Solidarity, like Paddy Gibson, like Adam Adelpo, like the people who organised the Kangaroo Point protests in Brisbane. These all, again, part of the same groups. They're all linked together. He's a linguistics professor at UCID, and he was part of helping to organise to get all the students to come out and join in these protests, which might see them get arrested or $1,000 on the spot fines. So, yeah, real duty of care there, Nick. Well done.
As a Melburnian, I'm quite conflicted about the New South Wales Police arresting these Marxists for protesting and breaching public health orders, because, obviously it's illegal to have any sort of protest here in Melbourne. You've seen the Freedom Day events being shut down brutally by Victoria Police, and also New South Wales Police showing that they are apolitical. They also brutally shut down the Freedom Day protest in Sydney's Hyde Park, which was showing solidarity, not in the communist term, with Victorians. It is good to see that the police are cracking down on these Marxist rebel rousers, but of course I don't believe that there should be restrictions on peaceful protests. So that's where I'm conflicted there. But of course it is, you know, lovely to see the Marxists screeching when they're getting arrested.
Oh, it is nice. And the one on Wednesday caused a bit of controversy because there was a law and social justice professor talking about those law degrees again. And he was forced to the ground by police because he was a part of the protest. And he came out later, he's written an article for Sydney Morning Herald about how terrible it was that he was temporarily placed under arrest and how it was a gigantic miscarriage of justice. And you had all these other academics screaming on Twitter about this, just completely raising hell. How dare you touch one of us? We are the holy people, the high priests. How dare you put your profane hands on our sacred persons, on the sacred person of one of our, one of the elect? And it was just, you can do whatever you like to those protesters in Melbourne. You can beat the crap out of them. You can run them over with your car if you feel like it. But oh, God, God, don't touch a professor. Don't touch one of the, the cardinals of the cathedral.
And the two New South Wales Green Marxists that you mentioned before, David Shoebridge and Jenny Leong, they have actually attended those University of Sydney events.
David Shoebridge was on the one on Wednesday.
But
he was a speaker.
But contrast that with the Victorian Greens leader Samantha Ratnam, who has voted for Dan's 6-month state of emergency extension. She voted in favour of the omnibus bill, and she hit out at far-right nationalists for undermining Victoria's public health response to the coronavirus. Well, it's not a public health response, it's a police state response, because, well, previously, the fines for illegal gatherings were $1,652, which still were the highest in Australia. Now they've been beefed up to $4,957. But it's the Victorian police state has just been the insane fines. There's some guy who's been fined 24 times, and they're not dragging him before the courts to jail him, which is the what seems to be occurring in Sydney.
Well, yeah, it's interesting to note the Greens' hypocrisy on this. It, I mean, there's a front group set up by mostly by Socialist Alternative in New South Wales, and they all these groups have front organisation after front organisation. Just to, they all usually always avoid working under their own names, and it's called Democracy is Essential, New South Wales. And the signatories to that, the like initial signatories to launch that project included Maureen Faruqi, the Greens senator, David Shoebridge, Jenny Leong, both Greens members of parliament, Jamie Parker, Greens member of parliament, Jonathan Sree from Brisbane again, and all signing on to a Marxist organised campaign saying that everyone should be able to protest. And then Samantha Ratnam in Melbourne is saying that is voting for bills to say that no one should be allowed to protest, even though there are similar levels of infection and death in New South Wales and Victoria, like you said before.
Though I should give a shout out to Maureen Faruqi's son, Osman Faruqi, who is now living and working in Melbourne, because he has been very critical of the Victorian police state and very critical of the Victorian government when it comes to contact tracing there, which is their poor contact tracing is partly why we're still in lockdown. So he is being, I would say, a consistent opponent of the police state.
Well, yes, but he was a consistent opponent right from the beginning, because he believed and went into all sorts of data mining to try and prove to himself and to everyone, all of his followers on Twitter, that the COVID lockdowns were originally targeting and disproportionately targeting Aboriginal people, and that it was all a gigantic racist plot. So once you've got up and sort of nailed your colours to the mast of coronavirus restrictions are all a racist plot by a white supremacist country, it's kind of hard to get down off that horse. So it's,
well, if you look at the breakdown of the fines that have been issued, they are disproportionately to non-white communities in proportion to their actual population size. And you've seen a lot of the lefty legal centres here, such as the Flemington and Kensington Legal Centre, which run the Police Accountability Project, and the Fitzroy Legal Centre. They've been very critical of the excesses of the fines and the police state. And of course, they're very left legal centres. So,
well, they were originally, both of those legal services were originally founded, I think, in the 70s and the 80s, depending on which one's which, by anarchists. They were originally anarchist organisations, back when anarchists did something other than running to journalists with names of people who said naughty things on the internet. So that was, they were started as left-wing extremist organisations, and it's, they still are connected to left-wing extremist organisations today. Anthony Kelly, who's with the Flemkent Legal Centre, he gave a talk on how to pretty much break the law to the anarchist book fair. I think it was a couple of years ago. And there's another one whose name I forget, the primary, who's been the primary, a woman who's been the primary lawyer in getting Victoria Police to stop doing stop and searches on African youths. She's been connected to Solidarity, Socialist Alternative and Socialist Alliance. So yeah, they've all got connections to left-wing extremists. So at least in that regard, they're being consistent, I guess.
I'm at the stage now, given not many people outside of Victoria understand how horrible it is. It's as bad, the lockdown is as bad as you've heard it is. So anyone who is opposing it and critiquing the Andrews government, whether they come from the far left or the far right, you know, I'm thankful for that. And I've even appreciated members of the hippie movement this year opposing the coronavirus lockdowns, arguing for free choice. So when it comes to things like vaccinations and medications, this is the surreal 2020 world.
Yeah, I'm not as forgiving as you, Tim.
Well, I am the Victorian here. You're a Queenslander.
Yes, but yeah, still no. These people want you dead. They want your kids dead. They want everyone in your family dead. They're willing to wait until you die, but they just want to make sure that people like you don't exist anymore.
Well, let's move on to because the main hard questions at Dan's daily press briefings have come from News Corp journalists. Obviously, Peter Credlin has a show on Sky News. Rachel Baxendale works for The Australian. Alex White, Herald Sun, Sophie Ellsworth, News Corp, Gabriella Power, Sky News. And the I stand with Dan cultist, you're not allowed to criticize him at all. And if they just got rid of the News Corp Murdoch journos, Dan would just be getting, basically, you could call them Dorothy Dix's questions.
Oh, yeah.
Every day. And Kevin Rudd, former Prime Minister, who seems to blame his failure as a Prime Minister on the Murdoch media. He has Murdoch derangement syndrome. He's called for a royal commission into the abuse of monopoly power of the Murdoch media, and has bragged that he's got over 200,000 signatures so far. And I get the feeling that when Dan's no longer Premier, he's like, I would have survive better politically through the pandemic if it wasn't for, you know, bloody Murdoch.
Yeah, it's the Murdoch derangement syndrome is real, and it serves a real psychological purpose for most people on the left. And it isn't an extreme left thing. It goes across most of the left. It's an excuse, because their ideas in their mind are so self-evidently true that the only way anyone could possibly disagree with them is if they're being brainwashed by nefarious actors, that people are too stupid to see what the truth is, because all they do is read misinformation and disinformation and fake news. And that's the only way that anyone could possibly disagree with me. It isn't that they could look at the same sort of ideas and come to a different conclusion. That's not possible. The conclusion is so self-evidently obvious and morally good. So there must be some sort of conspiracy around it. I love Kevin Rudd jumping on this, though. It is amazing. The guy who, in 2007 was endorsed by every single Murdoch newspaper in Australia, except for the Hobart Mercury and the Australian. And it's like, yeah, if there is a vast Rupert Murdoch conspiracy, Kevin, that conspiracy endorsed you. You're not living in the real world.
He was happy to take the endorsement at the time, but when it turned against him, then it's like, they're abusing their... I mean, this whole thing that they have a monopoly, I mean, it's less true now than ever. I mean, the Murdoch media empire is significantly smaller since 21st Century Fox was sold, and given that there's so much more online rags now that people read, and the fact that to read nearly any Murdoch publication or watch any Murdoch media, you have to pay for it.
Well, yeah, and the stuff that you don't isn't always right of centre.
News.com.au.
News.com.au is the most read news site in Australia, and it is free to air, or free to read. Yeah. And it is decidedly left of centre. And so the biggest Murdoch vehicle in Australia per eyeball is left wing. These people are not living in the real world, right? But they need to have a psychological grudge. They need to have someone to blame, right? There must be a conspiracy, because if there isn't a conspiracy, and that means they actually have to engage with the arguments of people who disagree with them. And they don't want to do that. Hey, who wants to do that? It's hard. Right? It's a lot easier to just say, these people must be stupid, brainwashed sheep. I'm the smart one. It's a very sort of flattering ideal to have. Right? And you see it not just sort of on the broad Australian left, you see it on the right as well. It's like when people say, the people protesting in the street, they must not have jobs. And, because I don't go out and protest in the street, I don't actually organise around causes that I care about. But they must not be as busy as me. It's like, well, the truth is most of them do have jobs. There's a significant minority who are very strong activists that help get those large crowds out there who are sort of student activists and that sort of stuff, but mostly those people do have jobs. And you're just lying to yourself. The same with the whole George Soros did it. George Soros must be paying all the Antifa. No, these people just genuinely really, really disagree with you. And they have a different worldview than you do. Probably can't live in the same country together considering how divergent those worldviews are. And that's the same sort of thing which presses so many people towards the Murdoch derangement syndrome thing. And it's just really quite strange when you see the left-wing journalists who work for Murdoch on Twitter trying to justify their employment to their friends on Twitter who are working, or usually these days not working, for other outlets. It's it's incredible. Because for a lot of them, to a lot of journalists who work for Murdoch Media, they are left-wing. Most of them are. The study that was done by the University of the Sunshine Coast showed that the majority of journalists who work for News Corp are left-wing. There's a larger minority that votes right-wing than in the rest of the media, but they are majority left-wing in their leanings. So every day they have to come to work and chuck on their Twitter on their phone and see all of their mates saying that they work for the evil, evil monolith which is causing everything in the world to go wrong, and no one wants to disagree with your friends, especially not left-wingers. They're not used to being challenged. Right? They grew up, went to primary school, went to high school, went to university, and then went straight into the workforce. And they've usually never really been in a situation where their ideas were in the minority and they ever felt challenged by it. They've lived in this bubble their entire lives, and now they're on Twitter, the ultimate of all bubbles. So, yeah, it's a really interesting sociological thing, and it is fucking terrifying that they genuinely don't care anymore about whether or not people who disagree with them should have any right to any platform whatsoever. It's clear that argument has been had. It's over. And they believe that while in the past, about 60, 70 years ago, left-wingers were arguing for free speech, that was just because they felt like they weren't entirely the establishment yet. Now they are the establishment. All the arguments have been settled. It's not just the science of climate change has been settled. All the arguments have been settled. And you can have any opinion you want, as long as it's from the extreme left to the center left. And everything outside of that, we tolerate you. Maybe, if we feel like it. And if you start winning, we smash up your events. We rip off your Trump hats. We beat the crap out of you and we shoot you in the street.
And those lefty journos at News Corp, they're more than happy to take Murdoch's money. But when they're working for another media outlet, then they're more than happy to bite the hand that previously fed them. Case in point, Rick Morton, who wrote for The Australian for many years. In fact, he was the main propagator of fake news about Gavin McGuinness that got him denied a visa to tour Australia. Now he's working for the Saturday paper, funded by Maurice Schwartz, who also funds Black Ink Books and Quarterly Essay. He, I think it was earlier this year, wrote a massive dump on his former employer, News Corp.
Oh, yeah, he actually came out and attacked News Corp whilst he was still working for them, saying that, we're all good left-wingers inside The Australian. There's like a resistance amongst left-wing journalists inside The Australian, but when the election starts coming around and then, you know, the editors come around, they put pressure on people to not have left-wing opinions. Like, yeah, it's because you're supposed to be the only classical liberal newspaper in Australia. The fact that the majority of you are left-wing that work there is kind of a red flag, to be honest. But he didn't see that as a problem. He saw the problem being trying to stop journalists from reporting on things the way that journalists want to. And most journalism comes from the humanities system, like we were talking about before. The same humanities system that produces those activists that attacked Scott Morrison in Queensland this week.
And even though they control the left, all of the mainstream media, the fact that there's one which is not completely left, they can't stand that.
Well, yeah, because that's why they see it is once that's gone, then everyone will agree with them.
And
it won't be the case, of course. They'll just find, but then they'll have to find a different thing, a different scapegoat to attack.
Well, that's where when they'll start to focus on more on people such as myself, Wilmsfront, the Unshackled, in that Josh Butler article, Christina Keneally, Shadow Home Affairs Minister, called me an extremist, and that called this show alt-right, even though I don't know what that term even means anymore.
Well, this is the thing. Christina Keneally is at the same time calling for right-wing extremist groups to be placed on the terrorist list, and she just called you a right-wing extremist.
Though it was good to see Liberal Senators Erica Betts and Conchita Ferravanti-Wells, both former ministers, basically call out ASIO for having this right-wing extremist classification, and saying to ASIO, you really need to redo this, because you're basically saying that, implying that those who have socially conservative views are right-wing extremists.
Well, yeah, left-wing extremists who openly say they want to overthrow the government, ambush the Prime Minister this week, and forced him to be hustled away by security in the back of a police car whilst they vandalised his ministerial vehicle. But ASIO is concentrating on right-wing extremists because Brenton Tarrant went down to Christchurch and was a retarded mass murderer. One guy, that's it, connected to no other group, connected to a member of no organisation. Whereas there are left-wing extremist organisations with membership who are lecturers teaching the next generation of teachers, teaching the next generation of lawyers, teaching the next generation of all sorts of members of the upper middle class and imparting their viewpoints onto them every single day whilst being paid by the taxpayer. And this is not really a concern at all. And even when these groups start attacking the Prime Minister, even when these groups are openly flouting the laws that are being put in place in New South Wales, I remember the ASIO guy coming out saying, oh, we're very worried about right-wing extremism. We've increased our stuff to 30% or 40% for right-wing extremism. It's just like fucking 50 guys nationwide who spend too much time on the internet.
Yeah, that's basically
Occasionally go out at night and put up edgy stickers and congratulate each other about how fucking retarded they are. That's essentially what we're talking about here. This is what an Australian senator in Christina Keneally is getting all hot under the collar about. Meanwhile, you've got groups like, well, Socialist Alternative has over 500 activists, and they are very dedicated and motivated activists, and they're on every single university campus in Australia. And that's just the biggest group. And there's a whole plethora of other groups as well.
Yeah. Christina to the right of Malcolm Turnbull as a far-right extremist. I mean, those who attend and speak at CPAC Australia are considered extremists in her mind. Ooh, she tried to get
clever.
CPAC 2019 shut down, and she must be extremely pleased that Lauren Southern has been cancelled from speaking at CPAC Australia 2020.
Well, yes, of course. And that would be partially because of the pressure being put on the culture by people like Christina Keneally. They understand how this war is fought. They understand how to fight a culture war. People on the right don't, which is why the right continues to lose. And I'm going to have to wrap up there, Tim.
Yep. I will reach the end of my questions here. It's been great to catch up with you, Lucas, and gain your insight, expertise, and information. And you do a good job with exposing all of this, even though most of it is publicly available information. It's just not reported on.
Thank you very much, Tim. Thanks for having a chat.
This is Will's Front, brought to you by theunshackled.net.
And we're back live. So I hope you enjoyed Lucas's expertise and insight there. And I'll include the links to all these latest articles in the show notes page. They're definitely worth worth checking out. And as I said during our interview, that this is all of these socialist personalities and groups, it's all publicly accessible information, yet the mainstream media don't cover any of it. And it's up to Lucas at the Unshackled to make sure that there's a media outlet out there which is exposing people. Now I'll get on to the other non-Victorian news for today. So the National Cabinet was supposed to take place this afternoon, but it's been rescheduled to next Friday. This was due to, well, Scott Morrison, he's in Cairns at the moment because he's been in Queensland all week campaigning for the LNP opposition leader, Depp Recklington. The Queensland state election is on October 31st on Halloween. Of all days. Yeah, obviously, Anastasia Palaszczuk has been the second worst state premier with her cruel border closures to sick people returning home from New South Wales to Queensland. She did give the people of Queensland the ability today to they're allowed 30 people indoor or outdoors at private gatherings now. That's now going to go up to 40 now. So obviously giving a bit more good news to Queenslanders' relaxation of restrictions going into the Queensland election campaign. So Scott Morrison, he couldn't make it to the National Cabinet meeting because the Royal Australian Air Force jet experienced technical issues, and apparently there was no secure phone hookup facility in Cairns. He said there was nothing really of importance to discuss with National Cabinet. So basically, yeah, the forum is functioning well if they can just delay a meeting until next week because there's nothing of urgency to discuss. Scott Morrison did hold a press conference. He was able to make it back later this afternoon to Sydney to provide a press conference, but not in time for National Cabinet. He announced the expansion of the Howard Springs quarantine facility, which is in the Northern Territory, to allow more returned travellers from overseas, particularly from India, South Africa, and the City of London. Now, Howard Springs quarantine facility, that is where Karen from Brighton, or real name Jodie Grolo, that's how she has escaped Dictator Dan's Victoria. Obviously, she shot to fame by telling a Nine News reporter that she got bored of walking the same places. That's why she was at the Tan, because she'd done all of Brighton. And Dan subsequently attacked her at his daily press conference. So Jodie Grolo, Karen from Brighton, she's become a bit of a local cult celebrity in Melbourne. She started an Instagram account sharing her views on Dan and the lockdown. She decided she'd had enough of putting up in Dan's Victoria. She's from two wealthy families. She married into the Grolo family. Her father is Bruce Atkinson, the Pokies King. So she was able to have the financial means to escape Victoria and go to the quarantine facility in Howard Springs in the Northern Territory. That is the only legitimate escape route from Victoria, even though obviously you have to pay for your own quarantine at the Howard Springs facility. She did it a lawful way. She's been posting on her Instagram some of the friends she's met at the Howard Springs quarantine facility. I guess you could call it a Victorian refugee camp. And as I mentioned, there's going to be people coming from South Africa to that facility as well, given the white genocide that's been happening in South Africa. You could call it a South African refugee camp as well, but it looks like the most luxurious, refugee camp, Howard Springs in the Northern Territory. It's just south of Darwin. Of course, the other major political story of the week was New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian dropping a bombshell on Monday morning that she was in an intimate relationship with a corrupt former Liberal MP Darryl Maguire. And obviously the big question was she complicit in his corruption? Did she turn a blind eye to it? Darryl Maguire has been in ICAC testimony for the past 3 days. There is no smoking gun that she was in any way complicit. The questions have been about, well, surely she knew enough to either disclose this relationship or made sure that he disclosed all his business dealings at the time. Obviously, there's a lot of the Sydney press pack have been demanding her resignation, particularly Andrew Clonell from Sky News, who was particularly aggressive towards her this morning with his line of questioning. In my opinion, no premier should resign before Daniel Andrews does. I'm still hoping that Dan retires before Christmas, because we've all had enough of hearing from him every day. And even though obviously Gladys has been sloppy in her personal life and showed a lack of judgment, the people of New South Wales are not under house arrest for 22 hours a day and are not forced to wear masks when they're outside. It's open for business. So yeah, it's basically just the Sydney press pack going into a frenzy about it in the great scheme of thing. Her relations with Darryl Maguire also didn't kill 800 people either. And now the reason why Wilmsfront is airing this Friday night show instead of the normal Trad Tasman talk, which is over on the Unshackled YouTube channel, is because tomorrow is the New Zealand general election. So we'll be doing a special Trad Tasman talk live stream with myself and Dewey DeBoer. There's the promo for tomorrow night. We hope to be joined by some special guests as well. So starting at 7 p.m. New Zealand time on the Right Minds YouTube channel and 5 p.m. Melbourne time on the Unshackled YouTube channel. And as is always with an election night live stream, we will be going until there's a result, until the victor claims victory and the vanquished concedes defeat. Based on the current polling, Jacinta Ardern looks like she will be re-elected. It's just a question was whether her Labor Party will be able to get an absolute majority using under New Zealand's mixed member proportional representation system, or will they have to go into a coalition with the New Zealand Greens under the leadership of Jamie Shaw. New Zealand First, under Winston Peters' leadership, they look on getting annihilated this election. They look like getting less than the 5% threshold to gain representation in the New Zealand Parliament. The party that looks like making a full return to the New Zealand Parliament is the Libertarian ACT Party. They've just had their sole MP, David Seymour, for many years. He's done a fantastic job standing up for first free speech after the Christchurch massacre. And he's also been a good advocate for freedom in 2020 against the Jacinta Ardern's lockdowns. And also, I should also mention post Christchurch as well, standing up for New Zealand gun owners as well. I know that Reg Penny is in the chat. I know that he is for firearms owners' rights. And so David Seymour in New Zealand, he's been the sole person to stand up for gun owners there in New Zealand. So his stance for freedom looks like being rewarded by the people of New Zealand. The ACT Party, they barely scraped 1% last election, but they look like they'll poll about 7 or 8%. Of course, it's not over until the votes are counted. We know how accurate polls can be. New National Opposition Leader Judith Collins, she's given it her best shot. She was only into the job last minute after the previous leader, Todd Muller, fell over, citing mental health issues. She's in the twilight of her career, Judith Collins. She's in her 60s. She was a police minister under John Key, where she got her nickname Judith Crusher Collins for her policy of vowing to crush the cars of hoons. And I may as well give some closing update on the development of the US election, which will be on Tuesday, November 3rd. We'll get the results Wednesday, November 4th. Obviously, the big story of the last 24 hours was the Hunter Biden emails and photos, which basically was the smoking gun that Burisma, that Ukrainian oil company, was basically the only reason they hired Hunter Biden was to get access to his dad, Joe Biden. And of course, Joe Biden bragged about getting the prosecutor fired, withholding Ukrainian aid money, which was investigating Burisma. So obviously it looks very bad. And on the abandoned laptop of Hunter Biden where these emails were found, there are also all those embarrassing photos of Hunter Biden, including him with a crack pipe. But of course, the even bigger scandal was Facebook and Twitter trying to stop users sharing it. They even blocked the New York Post's Twitter account, who was the publication which published this story. And today Twitter actually went down for several hours, had a whole outage. I guess that you'd say that's sort of karma. You're trying to sort of manipulate the US election and then your whole site goes down. Apparently it was just a technical issue. It wasn't a hack, but it was certainly, I thought, funny that happened to Twitter. As you all know, Twitter is not my preferred medium. I do obviously tweet unshackled content and occasionally reply to people, but certainly Twitter, in my view, is a sewer and not real life either, and politicians need to recognize that. So I'll see you all tomorrow night for the Trad Tasman Talk election night special, starting 5 p.m. Melbourne time on the Unshackled's YouTube channel. And the extra Wilms Front episodes just keep on coming, because I'll be back Monday night, 7 p.m. Melbourne time, on the Wilms Front YouTube DLive, and also on the Unshackled's YouTube page. My guest will be Millie Fontana, who has been another vocal anti-lockdown lobbyist during the second Melbourne lockdown. So I look forward to catching up with her. Thank you, everyone, for watching on this Friday night. Have a good weekend, and hopefully by the time the next Wilms Front episode air, some Melburnians and Victorians have got a lot of their freedoms back. All right, good night, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in to Wilms Front. Visit timwilms.com or Rational Rise TV to view the archive of episodes. And keep visiting theunshackled.net to view all our shows, and to keep up with the latest real news and analysis.